Right, that time. But did Neff deserve it? Was there shit about him I didn't know? Did he maybe like little girls in the wrong way, or push dope, or go after people too weak to fight back, like Skipper had gone after me with the shopping cart? "We want to help you use your talent for the betterment of all mankind," Mr. Sharpton said. And surely that didn't mean making a guy off himself because he thought the Defense Department was spending too much money on smart bombs. Paranoid shit like that is strictly for movies starring Steven Seagal and Jean-Claude Van Damme. Then I had a bad idea. A scary idea. Maybe Transcorp didn't want him dead because he wrote that stuff. Maybe they wanted him dead because people, the wrong people, were starting to think about what he wrote. "That's crazy," I said right out loud. And a woman looking into the window of Columbia City, oh so pretty, turned around and gave me the old fish eye. I ended up at the public library around 2 o'clock with my legs aching and my head throbbing. I kept seeing that guy in the bathtub with his wrinkled old man's tits and white chest hair, his nice smile gone, replaced by this vague Planet X look. I kept seeing him putting a baggie over his head, humming a Sinatra tune, My Way, maybe, as he snugged it down tight, then peered through it the way you'd peer through a cloudy window, so he could see to slit the veins in his wrists. I didn't want to see that stuff, but I couldn't stop. My bomb sight had turned into a telescope. They had a computer room in the library, and you could get on the internet at a very reasonable cost. I had to get a library card, too, but that was okay. A library card is good to have. You can never have too much ID. It took me only $3 worth of time to find Ann Tevich and call up the report of her death. The story started, I saw the sinking sensation, in the bottom right-hand corner of page 1, the official dead folks nook, and then jumped to the obituary page. Professor Tevich had been a pretty lady, blonde, 37. In the photo, she was holding her glasses in her hand, as if she wanted people to know she wore them, but as if she'd wanted people to see what pretty eyes she had, too. That made me feel sad and guilty. Her death was startlingly like Skipper's. Coming home from her office at UNM just after dark, maybe hurrying a little because it was her turn to make supper, but what the hell? Good driving conditions and great visibility. Her car, vanity license plate DNA fan, I happen to know, had veered off the road, overturned, and landed in a dry wash. She was still alive when someone spotted the headlights and found her, but there had never been any real hope. Her injuries were too grave. There was no alcohol in her system, and her marriage was in good shape. No kids, at least, thank God for small favors. So the idea of suicide was far-fetched. She had been looking forward to the future. She even talked about getting a computer to celebrate a new research grant. She'd refused to own a PC since 1988 or so, had lost some valuable data in one when it locked up, and had distrusted them ever since. She would use her department's equipment when she absolutely had to, but that was all. The coroner's verdict had been accidental death. Professor Ann Tevich, a clinical biologist, had been in the forefront of West Coast AIDS research. Another scientist, this one in California, said that her death might set back the search for a cure 5 years. She was a key player, he said. Smart, yes, but more. I once heard someone refer to her as a natural-born facilitator, and that's as good a description as any. Anne was the kind of person who holds other people together. Her death is a great loss to the dozens of people who knew and loved her, but it's an even greater loss to this cause. Billy Unger was also easy enough to find. His picture topped page 1 of the Stovington Weekly Current, instead of getting stuck down there in the dead folks' nook, but that might have been because there weren't many famous people in Stovington. Unger had been General William Rollum Unger, winner of the Silver Star and Bronze Star in Korea. During the Kennedy administration, he was an Undersecretary of Defense, Acquisition Reform, and one of the really big war hawks of that time. "Kill the Ruskies, drink their blood, keep America safe for the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade," that sort of thing. Then, around the time Lyndon Johnson was escalating the war in Vietnam, Billy Unger had a change of mind and heart. He began writing letters to newspapers. He started his op-ed page career by saying that we were handling the war wrong. He progressed to the idea that we were wrong to be in Vietnam at all. Then around 1975 or so, he got to the point of saying all wars were wrong. That was okay with most Vermonters. He served 7 terms in the state legislature, starting in 1978 when a group of progressive Democrats asked him to run for the U.S. Senate in 1996. He said he wanted to do some reading and consider his options. The implication was that he would be ready for a national career in politics by 2000, 2002 at the latest. He was getting old, but Vermonters like old guys, I guess. 1996 went past without Unger declaring himself a candidate for anything, possibly because his wife died of cancer. And before 2002 came around, he bought himself a big old dirt sandwich and ate every bite. There's a small but loyal contingent in Stovington which claimed Rollum's death was an accident, that Silver Star winners don't jump off their roofs even if they have lost a wife to cancer in the last year or so. But the rest pointed out that the guy probably hadn't been repairing the shingles, not in his nightshirt, not at 2 o'clock in the morning. Suicide was the verdict. Yeah, right. Kiss my ass and go to heaven. 18. I left the library and thought I'd head home. Instead, I went back to the same park bench again. I sat there until the sun was low and the place had pretty much emptied out of kids and frisbee-catching dogs. And although I'd been in Columbia City for 3 months by then, it was the latest I'd ever been out. That's sad, I guess. I thought I was living a life here, finally getting away from Ma and living a life, but all I've been doing is throwing a shadow. If people, certain people, were checking up on me, they might wonder why the change in routine. So I got up, went on home, boiled up a bag of that shit on a shingle stuff, and turned on my TV. I've got cable, the full package, including premium movie channels, and I've never seen a single bill. How's that for an eventual deal? I turned on Cinemax. Rutger Hauer was playing a blind karate fighter. I sat down on the couch beneath my fake Rembrandt and watched the show. I didn't see it, but I ate my chow and looked at it. I thought about stuff. About a newspaper columnist who had liberal ideas and a conservative readership. About an AIDS researcher who served an important linking function with other AIDS researchers. About an old general who changed his mind. I thought about the fact that I only knew these three by name because they didn't have modems and email capability. There was other stuff to think about, too. Like how you could hypnotize a talented guy or drug him, or maybe even expose him to other talented guys in order to keep him from asking any of the wrong questions or doing any of the wrong things. Like how you could make sure such a talented guy couldn't run away even if he happened to wake up to the truth. You do that by setting him up in what was, essentially, a cashless existence. A life where rule number one was no rat-holing any extra dough, not even pocket change. What sort of talented guy would fall for something like that? A naive one, with few friends and next to no self-image. A guy who would sell you his talented soul for a few groceries and $70 a week because he believes that's about what it's worth. I didn't want to think about any of that. I tried to concentrate on Rutger Hauer, doing all that amusing blind karate shit. Pug would have laughed his ass off if he'd been there, believe me. So I wouldn't have to think about any of that. 200, for instance. There was a number I didn't want to think about. 200. 10 times 20, 40 times 5. CC to the old Romans. At least 200 times I'd push the button that brought the message Dinky Mail sent up on my screen. It occurred to me, for the first time as if I was finally waking up, that I was a murderer. A mass murderer. Yes, indeed, that's what it comes down to. Good of mankind, bad of mankind, indifferent of mankind. Who makes those judgments? Mr. Sharpton? His bosses, their bosses, and does it matter? I decided it didn't matter a fuck in a rabbit hutch. I further decided I really couldn't spend too much time moaning, even to myself, how I had been drugged, hypnotized, or exposed to some kind of mind control. The truth was, I'd been doing what I was doing because I loved the feeling I got when I was composing the special letters. The feeling that there was a river of fire running through the center of my head. Mostly, I'd been doing it because I could. "That's not true," I said, but not real loud. I whispered it under my breath. "They probably don't have any bugs planted here. I'm sure they don't, but it's best to be safe." I started writing this, what is it, a report, maybe. I started writing this report later that night, as soon as the Rutger Hauer movie was over, in fact. I write in a notebook, though, not on my computer. And I write in plain old English, no sankophytes, no bews, no smims. There's a loose floor tile under the ping-pong table down in the basement. That's where I keep my report. I just now looked back at how I started. "I've got a good job now," I wrote, "and no reason to feel glum. Idiotic." But of course, any fool who can pucker is apt to whistle past the graveyard. When I went to bed that night, I dreamed I was in the parking lot of the Super Saver. Pug was there wearing his red duster and a hat on his head like the one Mickey Mouse wore in Fantasia. That's the movie where Mickey played the sorcerer's apprentice. Halfway across the parking lot, shopping carts were lined up in a row. Pug would raise his hand, then lower it. Each time he did this, a cart would start rolling by itself, gathering speed, rushing across the lot until it crashed into the brick side of the supermarket. They were piling up there, a glittering junk heap of metal and wheels. For once in his life, Pug wasn't smiling. I wanted to ask him what he was doing and what it meant, but of course I knew. "He's been good to me," I told Pug in this dream. It was Mr. Sharpton I meant, of course. "He's been really, really eventual." Pug turned fully to me then, and I saw it wasn't Pug at all. It was Skipper. And his head had been smashed in all the way down to the eyebrows. Shattered hunks of skull stuck up in a circle, making him look like he was wearing a bone crown. "You're not looking through a bomb sight," Skipper said and grinned. "You are the bomb sight. How do you like that, Dinkster?" I woke up in the dark of my room, sweating, with my hands over my mouth to hold in a scream. So I guess I didn't like it very much. 19. Writing this has been a sad education, let me tell you. It's like, "Hey, Dink, welcome to the real world." Mostly it's the image of grinding up dollar bills in the kitchen pig that comes to me when I think about what has happened to me. But I know that's only because it's easier to think of grinding up money or chucking it into the storm drain than it is to think about grinding up people. Sometimes I hate myself. Sometimes I'm scared for my immortal soul, if I have one. And sometimes I'm just embarrassed. "Trust me," Mr. Sharpton said, and I did. I mean, duh. How dumb can you get? I tell myself I'm just a kid, the same age as the kids who crewed those B-52s I sometimes think about, that kids are allowed to be dumb, but I wonder if that's true when lives are at stake. Of course, I'm still doing it. Yes. I thought at first that I wouldn't be able to, no more than the kids in Mary Poppins could keep floating around the house when they lost their happy thoughts. But I could. And once I sat down in front of the computer screen and that river of fire started to flow, I was lost. You see, at least I think you do, this is what I was put on planet Earth for. Can I be blamed for doing the thing that finishes me off, that completes me? Answer, yes. Absolutely. But I can't stop. Sometimes I tell myself that I've gone on because if I do stop, maybe even for a day, they'll know I've caught on, and the cleaners will make an unscheduled stop. Except what they'll clean up this time will be me. But that's not why. I do it because I'm just another addict. Same as a guy smoking crack in an alley or some chick taking a spike in her arm. I do it because of the hateful fucking rush. I do it because when I'm working in Dinky's notebook, everything's eventual. It's like being caught in a candy trap, and it's all the fault of that dork who came out of News Plus with his fucking dispatch open. If not for him, I'd still see nothing but cloud hazy buildings and the crosshairs. No people, just targets. "You are the bomb site," Skipper said in my dream. You are the bombsite, Dinkster. That's true. I know it is. Horrible, but true. I'm just another tool. Just the lens the real bombardier looks through. Just the button he pushes. What bombardier, you ask? Oh, come on, get real. I thought of calling him. How's that for crazy? Or maybe it's not.
Call me any time, Dink. Even 3 in the morning.
That's what the man said, and I'm pretty sure that's what the man meant. About that, at least Mr. Sharpton wasn't lying. I thought of calling him and saying, You want to know what hurts the most, Mr. Sharpton? That thing you said about how I can make the world a better place by getting rid of people like Skipper. The truth is, you're the guys like Skipper. Sure, and on the shopping cart they chase people with, laughing and barking and making race car sounds. I work cheap, too, at bargain basement rates. So far I've killed over 200 people, and what did it cost Transcorp? A little house in a third-rate Ohio town? $70 a week and a Honda automobile, plus cable TV, don't want to forget that. I stood there for a while looking at the telephone, then put it down again. Couldn't say any of that. It would be the same as putting a baggie over my head and then slitting my wrists. So what am I going to do? Oh, God. What am I going to do? 20. It's been 2 weeks since I last took this notebook out from under the basement tile and wrote in it. Twice I've heard the mail slot clack on Thursdays during As the World Turns and gone out into the hall to get my money. I've gone to 4 movies, all in the afternoon. Twice I've ground up money in the kitchen pig and thrown my loose change down the storm drain, hiding what I was doing behind the blue plastic recycling basket when I put it down on the curb. One day I went down to News Plus, thinking I'd get a copy of Variations or Forum. There was a headline on the front of the dispatch that, once again, took away any sexy feelings I might have had. Pope dies of heart attack on peace mission, it said. Did I do it? Nah, the story said he died in Asia, and I've been sticking to the American Northwest these last few weeks. But I could have been the one. If I'd been nosing around in Pakistan last week, I very likely would have been the one. 2 weeks of living in a nightmare. Then, this morning, there was something in the mail. Not a letter. I've only gotten 3 or 4 of those, all from Pug, and now he's stopped writing, and I miss him so much. But a Kmart advertising circular. It flopped open just as I was putting it into the trash, and something fluttered out. A note printed in block letters. Do you want out? It read. If yes, send message. Don't stand so close to me is best police song. My heart was beating hard and fast, the way it did on the day I came into my house and saw the Rembrandt print over the sofa where the velvet clowns had been. Below the message, someone had drawn a Fowder. It was harmless just sitting there all by itself, but looking at it still made all the spit in my mouth dry up. It was a real message. The Fowder proved it, but who had it come from? And how did the sender know about me? I went into the study walking slowly with my head down, thinking. A message tucked into an advertising circular. Hand-printed and tucked into an advertising circular. That meant someone close. Someone in town. I turned on my computer and modem. I called the Columbia City Public Library where you can surf cheap and in relative anonymity. Anything I sent would go through Transcorp in Chicago, but that wasn't going to matter. They weren't going to suspect a thing, not if I was careful. And of course, if there was anybody there. There was. My computer connected with the library's computer and a menu flashed on my screen. Just for a moment, something else flashed on my screen as well. A smim. In the lower right-hand corner, just a flicker. I sent the message about the best police song and added a little touch of my own down in the dead folks' nook. A sankofite. I could write more. Things have started to happen, and I believe that soon they'll be happening fast. But I don't think it would be safe. Up to now, I've just talked about myself. If I went any further, I'd have to talk about other people. But there are two more things I want to say. First, that I'm sorry for what I've done, for what I did to Skipper, even. I'd take it back if I could. I didn't know what I was doing. I know that's a piss-poor excuse, but it's the only one I have. Second, I've got it in mind to write one more special letter, the most special of all. I have Mr. Sharpton's email address, and I have something even better. A memory of how he stroked his lucky tie as we sat in his big, expensive Mercedes. The loving way he ran his palm over those silk swords. So you see, I know just enough about him. I know just what to add to his letter, how to make it eventual. I can close my eyes and see one word floating there in the darkness behind my lids. Floating there like black fire, deadly as an arrow fired into the brain. And it's the only word that matters. Excalibur.
Shook our senses with the shining. He caressed our fears with caring. And now, he beckons sinister forces from the depths of our psyche with bag of bones. Ladies and gentlemen, reading his short story, LT's Theory of Pets, will you please welcome Stephen King.
Thank you very much. I want to thank you all for coming, and I think we'll have a pretty good time for people who are all going to die someday. And I'm going to read you this story, but before I do, I just want to remind you of a couple of things. First is, we're all in here together now, and we're fairly safe, but later on you'll have to go to your cars. And it will be dark. And there are mad people in the city, we know that. It's just a fact of life, and I don't want to scare you unduly, but there could be somebody in your back seat. It's not likely, but you'll admit that it is possible, and you wouldn't want to be driving home and look in your rearview mirror and see somebody there, would you? So check. What does it hurt? It doesn't hurt to check. The other thing is, I'd like you to take a moment now, before I begin reading this story, to ask yourself one question. Did I leave the shower curtain open or closed? And if you feel that you left the shower curtain open and it's closed when you get back, I suggest you get out of your place in a hurry. Again, I don't want to scare you unduly, but these things have to be considered. Muriel Gray is going to present some questions in the second half of this program. if I survive the first half without a cataclysmic heart attack. It's always a possibility. We're always only an inch or two away, aren't we, from whatever's going to happen. I don't want to upset you with that or make you anxious, but it is the fact. She's got a list of questions that we're going to answer some of them. But the first question that I saw on her list is horror all you write? And the answer, of course, is not on purpose. It's just that things seem to drift that way after a while. And I had an idea for a story, this goes back about a year, about people and their pets. Somebody had said something to me, you know, ideas start when you least expect them. Somebody said, have you ever noticed that people's pets grow to be like them as time goes by? And it occurred to me that, yes, that was true. People with sweet natures had sweet-natured pets, and people with sort of bad tempers generally had dogs. You had to mind your ankles. So I started to have an idea for a story about a marriage that was sort of in trouble and people who bought each other pets. And I thought to myself, if the pets started to like the wrong member of this partnership, that would be sort of funny. You'd be surprised how many of my stories start with the idea of that would be sort of funny. I set out to write a funny story that would be rather rude. If rude language offends you, I suggest you cover your ears. I set out to write a story that I thought would be funny. It sort of drifted toward this other area, toward the end. So this is called LT's Theory of Pets. Hasn't been published in Great Britain yet, and depending on your reaction, may never be published in Great Britain. LT's Theory of Pets. My friend, LT, hardly ever talks about how his wife disappeared or how she's probably dead, just another victim of the Axeman. But he likes to tell the story of how she walked out on him. He does it with just the right roll of the eyes, as if to say, she fooled me, boys, right good and proper. He'll sometimes tell the story to a bunch of men sitting on one of the loading docks behind the plant and eating their lunches, him eating his lunch too, the one he fixed himself. No Lulu Bell back at home to do it for him these days. They usually laugh when he tells the story, which always ends with LT's theory of pets. Hell, I usually laugh. It's a funny story, even if you do know how it turned out. And not that any of us do. Not completely. I punched out at 4, just like usual, LT will say, then went down to Deb's den for a couple of beers, just like most days. Had a game of pinball, then went home. That was when things stopped being just like usual. When a person gets up in the morning, he doesn't have the slightest idea how much may have changed in his life by the time he lays his head down again that night. Ye know not the hour or the day, the Bible says. I believe that particular verse is about dying, but it fits everything else, boys. Everything else in the world. You just never know when you're going to bust a fiddle string. When I turn into the driveway, I see the garage doors open and the little Subaru she brought to the marriage is gone, but that doesn't strike me as immediately peculiar. She was always driving off someplace to a yard sale or someplace and leaving the goddamn garage door open. I tell her, Lulu, if you keep doing that long enough, somebody will eventually take advantage of it, come in and take a rake or a bag of peat moss or maybe even the power mower. Hell, even a Seventh-day Adventist fresh out of college and doing his merit badge rounds will steal if you put enough temptation in his way. And that's the worst kind of person to tempt because they feel it more than the rest of us. Anyway, she'd say, I'll do better, LT. Try anyway. I really will, honey. And she did do better, just backslid from time to time like any ordinary sinner. I park off to the side so she'll be able to get her car in when she comes back from wherever, but I close the garage door. Then I go in by way of the kitchen. I check the mailbox, but it's empty. The mail inside on the counter, so she must have left after 11 because he don't come till at least then. The mailman, I mean. Well, Lucy's right there by the door, crying in that way Siamese have. I like that cry. Think it's kind of cute. But Lulu always hated it, maybe because it sounds like a baby's cry, and she didn't want anything to do with babies. What would I want with a rug monkey, she'd say. Lucy being at the door wasn't anything out of the ordinary either. That cat loved my ass. Still does. She's 2 years old now. We got her at the start of the last year we were married, right around. Seems impossible to believe Lulu's been gone a year, and we were only together 3 to start with. But Lulu Bell was the type to make an impression on you. Lulu Bell had what I have to call star quality. You know who she reminded me of? Lucille Ball. Now that I think about it, I guess that's why I named the cat Lucy, although I don't remember thinking it at the time. It must have been what you'd call a subconscious association. She'd come into a room, Lulu Bell, I mean, not the cat, and just light it up somehow. A person like that, when they're gone, you can hardly believe it. You keep expecting them to come back. Meanwhile, there's the cat. Her name was Lucy to start with, but Lulu Bell hated the way she acted so much that she started to call her Screw Lucy, and it kind of stuck. Lucy wasn't nuts, though. She only wanted to be loved. Wanted to be loved more than any other pet I've ever had in my life, and I've had quite a few. Anyway, I come into the house and pick up the cat and pet her a little, and she climbs up onto my shoulder and sits there purring and talking her Siamese talk. I check the mail on the counter, put the bills in the basket, then go over to the fridge to get Lucy something to eat. I always keep a working can of cat food in there with a piece of tinfoil over the top. Saves having Lucy get excited and digging her claws into my shoulder when she hears the can opener. Cats are smart, you know. Much smarter than dogs. They are different in other ways, too. It might be the biggest division in the world isn't men and women, but folks who like cats and folks who like dogs. Did any of you pork packers ever think of that? Lulu bitched like hell about having an open can of cat food in the fridge, even one with a piece of foil over the top, said it made everything in there taste like old tuna, but I wouldn't give in on that one. On most stuff, I did it her way, but that cat food business was one of the few places where I really stood up for my rights. Didn't have anything to do with the cat food anyway. It had to do with a cat. She just didn't like Lucy, that was all. Lucy was her cat, but she didn't like it. Anyway, I go over to the fridge, and I see there's a note on it, stuck there with one of the vegetable magnets. It's from Lulu Bell. Best I can remember, it goes like this. Dear LT, I am leaving you, honey. Unless you come home early, I will be long gone by the time you get this note. I don't think you will get home early. You never have got home early in all the time we've been married. But at least I know you'll get this almost as soon as you get in the door, because the first thing you always do when you get home isn't to come see me and say, hi, sweet girl, I'm home, and give me a kiss, but go to the fridge and get whatever's left of that last nasty can of Kahlo you put in there and feed Screw Lucy. So at least I know you just won't go upstairs and get shocked when you see my Elvis Last Supper picture is gone and my half of the closet is mostly empty and think we had a burglar who likes ladies' dresses, unlike some who only care what is under them. I get irritated with you sometime, honey, but I still think you're sweet and kind and nice, and you will always be my little maple duff and sugar dumpling, no matter where our paths may lead. It's just that I have decided I was never cut out to be a spam packer's wife. I don't mean that in any conceited way either. I even called the psychic hotline last week as I struggled with this decision, lying awake night after night and listening to you snore. Boy, do you have a snore on you. I don't mean to hurt your feelings, but you do. And I was given this message: a broken spoon may become a fork. I didn't understand that at first, but I didn't give up on it. I may not be smart like some people, and like some people who think they are, but I work at things. The best mill grinds slow but exceedingly fine, my mother used to say, and I ground away at this like a peppermill in a Chinese restaurant, thinking late at night while you snored and no doubt dreamed of how many pork snouts you could get in one can of Spam. And it came to me, that saying about how a broken spoon can become a fork is a beautiful thing to behold, because a fork has tines, and those tines may have to separate, like you and me must now have to separate, but still, they have the same handle. So do we, We are both human beings, LT, capable of loving and respecting one another. Look at the fights we have had about Frank and Screw Lucy, and still we mostly manage to get along. Yet the time has now come for me to seek my fortune along different lines from yours and to poke into the great roast of life with different points from yours. Besides, I miss my mother. Now, I can't say for sure how much, if any, of this stuff was really in the note LT found on his fridge. It doesn't seem entirely likely, I must admit. But the men listening to his story would be rolling in the aisles by this point, or around the loading dock at least, and it did sound like Lulu Bell. That I can testify to. Please do not try to follow me, LT, and although I'll be at my mother's, and I know you have that number, I would appreciate you not calling, but waiting for me to call you. In time, I will. But in the meantime, I have a lot of thinking to do, and although I have gotten a fair way with it, I'm not out of the fog yet. I suppose I will be asking you for a divorce eventually, and think it is only fair to tell you so. I have never been one to hold out false hope, believing it's better to tell the truth and smoke out the devil. Please remember that what I do in love, not in hatred and resentment. And please remember what was told to me and what I now tell to you. A broken spoon may be a fork in disguise. All my love, Lulu Bell Sims. LT would pause there, letting them digest the fact that she had gone back to her maiden name and giving his eyes a few of those patented LT DeWitt rolls. Then he'd tell them about the P.S. that she tacked on the note. I have taken Frank with me and left Screw Lucy for you. I thought this would probably be the way you'd want it. Love, Lulu. If the DeWitt family was a fork, Screw Lucy and Frank were the other two tines on it. If there wasn't a fork, and speaking for myself, I've always felt marriage was more like a knife, the dangerous kind with two sharp edges. Screw Lucy and Frank could still be said to sum up everything that went wrong with the marriage of LT and Lulu Bell. Because, think of it, although Lulu Bell bought Frank for LT, first wedding anniversary, and LT bought Lucy, soon to be Screw Lucy, for Lulu Bell, second wedding anniversary, they each wound up with the other one's pet when Lulu walked out of the marriage. She got me that dog because I like the one on Frasier, LT would say. That kind of dog's a terrier, but I don't remember now what they call that kind. A Jack something. Jack Spratt? Jack Robinson? Jack Shit? You know how a thing like that gets on the tip of your tongue? Somebody would tell him that Frasier's dog was a Jack Russell Terrier, and LT would nod emphatically. That's right, he'd exclaim. Sure, exactly. That's what Frank was, all right, a Jack Russell Terrier. But you want to know the cold, hard truth? An hour from now, that will have slipped away from me again. It'll be there in my brain, but like something behind a rock. An hour from now, I'm going to be saying to myself, what did that guy say Frank was? A Jack Handel Terrier? A Jack Rabbit Terrier? That's close. I know it's close. And so on. Why? I think it's because I just hated that little fuck so much. That barking rat. That fur-covered shit machine. I hated it from the first time I laid eyes on it. There. It's out of me, and I'm glad. And do you know what? Frank felt the same about me. That's right. It was hate at first sight. You know how some men train their dog to bring them their slippers? Frank wouldn't bring me my slippers, but he'd puke in them. Yes. The first time he did it, I stuck my foot right into it. It was like sticking your foot into a warm tapioca with extra big lumps in it. Although I didn't see him, my theory is that he waited outside the bedroom door until he saw me coming. Fucking lurked outside the bedroom door. Then went in, unloaded in my right slipper, and then hid under the bed to watch the fun. I deduced that on the basis of how the puke was still warm. Fucking dog. Man's best friend, my ass. I wanted to take it to the pound after that. Had the leash out and everything, but Lulu threw an absolute fit. You would have thought she'd come into the kitchen and caught me trying to give the dog a drain cleaner enema. If you take Frank to the pound, you might as well take me to the pound, she says, starting to cry. That's all you think of him, and that's all you think of me. Honey, all we are is nuisances you'd like to be rid of. That is the cold, hard truth. I mean, oh, my bleeding piles, on and on. He puked in my slipper, I says. The dog puked in his slipper, so off with his head, she says. Oh, sugar pie, if you could only hear yourself. Hey, I say, try sticking your bare foot into a slipper filled with dog puke and see how you like it. Getting mad by then, you know. Except getting mad at Lulu never did any good. Most times, if you had the king, she had the ace. If you had the ace, she had a trump. Also, the woman would fucking escalate. If something happened and I got irritated, she'd get pissed. If I got pissed, she'd get mad. If I got mad, she'd go fucking red alert DEFCON 1 and empty the missile silos. I'm talking scorched earth here. Mostly it wasn't worth it, except almost every time we'd get into a fight, I'd forget that. She'd go, oh dear, Maple Duff stuck his widow footy in a widow spit up. I tried to get in there, tell her that wasn't right. Spit up is like drool. Spit up doesn't have these big fucking chunks in it. But she won't let me get a word in. By then, she's really in the passing lane. She's all pumped up and she's ready to teach school. Let me tell you something, honey, she goes. A little drool in your slipper is very minor stuff. You men slay me. Try being a woman sometimes, okay? Try always being the one that ends up laying with the small of your back in that cum spot. Or the one that goes to the toilet in the middle of the night and the guy's left the goddamn ring up and you splash your can right down into this cold water, a little midnight skin diving. The toilet probably hasn't been flushed either. Men think the urine fairy comes around 2 a.m. They think the urine fairy comes around 2 a.m. and takes care of that. And there you are, sitting crack deep in piss. And all at once you realize your feet are in it too. You're paddling around in lemon squirt because although guys think they're dead-eyed dick with that thing, most can't shoot for shit. Drunk or sober, they gotta wash the goddamn floor all around the toilet before they can even start the main event. All my life, I've been living with this, honey. A father, four brothers, one ex-husband, plus a few roommates that are none of your business at this late date. And you're ready to send poor Frank off to the gas factory because one time he happened to reflux a little drool into your slipper. My fur-lined slipper, I tell her, but it's just a little shot back over my shoulder. One thing about living with Lulu, and maybe to my credit, I always knew when I was beat. When I lost it, it was fucking decisive. One thing I certainly wasn't going to tell her was, even though I knew it for a fact, that the dog that puked in my slipper on purpose, the same way that he peed on my underwear on purpose, if I forgot to put it in the hamper before I went off to work. She can leave her bras and pants scattered around from hell to Harvard, and did. But if I left so much as a pair of athletic socks in the corner, I'd come home and find that jack shit terrier had given it a lemonade shower. But tell her that? She would have been booking me time with a psychiatrist. She would have been doing that even though she knew it was true. Because then she might have to take the stuff seriously, and she didn't want to. She loved Frank, you see. And Frank loved her. They were like Romeo and Juliet or Rocky and Adrian. Frank would come to her chair when we were watching TV. He'd lie down on the floor beside her and put his muzzle on her shoe. Just lie there all night like that, looking up at her, all soulful and loving, with his little butt pointed in my direction. So if he should have to blow a little gas, I'd get the full benefit of it. He loved her and she loved him. Why? Christ knows. Love's a mystery to everyone except the poets, I guess, and nobody sane can understand a thing they say about it. I don't think most of them can understand it themselves on the rare occasions when they wake up and smell the coffee. But Lulu Bell never gave me that dog so she could have it. Let's get that one thing straight. I know that some people do stuff like that. A guy will give his wife a trip to Miami because he wants to go there. Or a wife will give her husband a Nordic track because she thinks he ought to do something about his gut. But this wasn't that kind of deal. We were crazy in love with each other at the beginning. I know I was with her, and I'd stake my life that she was with me. No, she bought that dog for me because I always laughed so hard at the one on Fraser. She wanted to make me happy, that's all. She didn't know Frank was going to take a shine to her, or her to him, no more than she knew the dog was going to dislike me so much that throwing up in one of my slippers and chewing the bottoms of the curtains on my side of the bed would be the high point of its day. LT wouldn't look around at the grinning men, not grinning himself, but he'd give his eyes that knowing, long-suffering roll, and they'd laugh again in anticipation. Me too, likely as not, in spite of what I knew about the Axe Man. "I haven't ever been hated before," he'd say, "not by man or beast, and it unsettled me a lot. It unsettled me big time." I tried to make friends with Frank, first for my sake, then for the sake of her who gave him to me, but it didn't work. For all I know, he might have tried to make friends with me, with a dog, who can tell? And if he did, it didn't work for him either. Since then I've read, in Dear Abby, I think it was, that a pet is just about the worst present you can give a person, and I agree. I mean, even if you like the animal, and the animal likes you, think about what that kind of gift says. "Say, darling, I'm giving you this wonderful present. It's a machine that eats at one end and shits out the other, and it's going to be with you for 15 years, give or take. Merry fucking Christmas." But that's the kind of thing you only think about after, more often than not. You know what I mean? I think we tried to do our best, Frank and I. After all, even though we hated each other's guts, we both loved Lulu Bell. That's why I think that although he'd sometimes growl at me if I sat down next to her on the couch during Murphy Brown or a movie or something, he never actually bit. Still, it used to drive me crazy. Just the nerve of it, that little bag of hair and eyes daring to growl at me. "Listen to him," I'd say. "He's growling at me." She'd stroke his head the way she hardly ever stroked mine, unless she'd had a few, and say it was really just the dog's version of purring. That he was just happy to be with us, having a quiet evening at home. I'll tell you something, though. I never tried patting him when she wasn't around. I'd feed him sometimes, and I never gave him a kick, although if I didn't say I was tempted a few times, I'd be a liar. But I never tried patting him. I think he would have snapped at me, and then we would have gotten into it. Like two guys living with the same pretty girl, almost. Menage a trois is what they call it in the penthouse forum. Both of us love her, and she loves both of us, but as time goes by, I start realizing that the scales are tipping, and she's starting to love Frank a little more than me. Maybe because Frank never talks back and never pukes in her slippers. And with Frank, the goddamn toilet ring is never an issue, because he goes outside. Unless, that is, I forget and leave a pair of my undershorts in the corner or under the bed. At this point, LT would likely finish off the iced coffee in his thermos, crack his knuckles or both. It was his way of saying that the first act was over and act two was about to commence. So then, one day, Saturday, Lulu and I are out at the mall, just walking around, you know, the way people do, you know, and we go by the Pet Notions up by JCPenney, and there's a whole crowd of people up in the display window. "Oh, let's see," Lulu says. So we go over to the display window and we work our way to the front. It's a fake tree with bare branches and fake grass, astroturf, all around it. And there are these Siamese kittens, half a dozen of them, chasing each other around, climbing the tree, batting each other's ears. "Oh, ain't they just the cutest ones," Lulu says. "Oh, ain't they just the cutest little babies. Yook, honey, yook." "I'm looking," I says. And what I'm thinking is that I just found what I wanted to get Lulu for our anniversary. And that was a relief. I wanted it to be something extra special, something that would really bowl her over, because things had been quite a bit short of great between us during the last year. I thought about Frank, but I wasn't too worried about him. Cats and dogs always fight in the cartoons, but in real life, they usually get along. That's been my experience. They usually get along better than people do, especially when it's cold outside. To make a long story just a little bit shorter, I bought one of them and gave it to her for our anniversary. Got it a velvet collar and tucked a little card underneath it. "Hello, I am Lucy," the card said. "I come with love from LT. Happy second anniversary." You probably know what I'm going to tell you now, don't you? Sure. It was like goddamn Frank the Terrier all over again, only in reverse. At first, I was as happy as a pig in shit with Frank, and Lulu Bell was as happy as a pig in shit with Lucy. Held her up over her head, talking that baby talk to her. "Oh, look at you. Oh, look at you, my widow precious. Oh, she's so cute." And on and on. Until Lucy let out a yowl and batted the end of Lulu Bell's nose. With her claws out, too. Then she ran away and hid under the kitchen table. Lulu laughed it off like it was the funniest thing she'd ever had happen to her. And just as cute as anything else a little kitten might do. But I could see she was miffed. Right then, Frank came in. He'd been sleeping up in our room at the foot of her side of the bed. But Lulu let out a little shriek when the kitten batted her nose, so he came down to see what the fuss was about. He spotted Lucy under the table right away and walked toward her, sniffing the linoleum where she'd been. "Stop them, honey. Stop them, LT. They're going to get into it," Lulu Bell says. "Frank'll kill her." "Just let them alone a minute," I say. "See what happens." Lucy humped up her back the way cats do, but stood her ground and watched them come. Lulu started forward, wanting to get in between them in spite of what I'd said. Listening up wasn't exactly one of Lulu's strong points, but I took her wrist and held her back. It's best to let them work it out between them if you can. Always best. It's quicker. Well, Frank got to the edge of the table, poked his nose under, and started this low rumbling way in the back of his throat. "Let me go, LT. I gotta get to her," Lulu Bell says. "Frank's growling at her." "No, he's not," I say. "He's just purring." I recognize it from all the times he's purred at me. She gave me a look that just about would have boiled water, but she didn't say anything. The only times in the 3 years we were married that I got in the last words, it was always about Frank and Screw Lucy. Strange but true. Any other subject, Lulu could talk rings around me, but when it came to the pets, it seemed as though she were always fresh out of comebacks. Used to drive her crazy. Frank poked his nose under the table a little further, and Lucy batted at his nose the way she batted at Lulu Bell's. Only when she batted at Frank, she did it without popping her claws. I had an idea Frank would go for her, but he didn't. He just kind of woofed and turned away. Not scared, but more like he's thinking, "Oh, okay, so that's what that's about." Went back into the living room and laid down in front of the TV. And that was all the confrontation there ever was between them. They divvied up the territory pretty much the way that Lulu and I divvied up that last year we spent together when things were getting bad. The bedroom belonged to Frank and Lulu. The kitchen belonged to me and Lucy. Only by Christmas, Lulu Bell was calling her Screw Lucy. And the living room was neutral territory. The four of us spent a lot of evenings there that last year. Screw Lucy on my lap, Frank with his muzzle on Lulu's shoe, us humans on the couch, Lulu Bell reading a book, and me watching Wheel of Fortune or Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, which Lulu Bell always called Lifestyles of the Rich and Topless. The cat wouldn't have anything to do with her. Not from that day one. Frank, every now and then, you could get the idea that Frank was at least trying to get along with me. His nature would always get the better of him in the end, and he'd chew up one of my sneakers or take another leak on my underwear. But every now and then, it did seem as though he were putting forth an effort. Lap my hand or maybe give me a grin, usually if I had a plate of something he wanted a little of, though. Cats are different, though. A cat won't curry favor, even if it's in their best interest to do so. A cat can't be a hypocrite. If more preachers were like cats, this would be a religious country again. If a cat likes you, you know. If she don't, you know that too. Screw Lucy never liked Lulu, not one whit, and she made it clear from the start. If I was getting ready to feed her, Lucy would rub around my legs, purring, while I spooned it up and dumped it in her dish. If Lulu fed her, Lucy would sit all the way across the kitchen, in front of the fridge, watching her. and wouldn't go to the dish until Lulu had cleared off. It drove Lulu crazy. "That cat thinks she's the Queen of Sheba," she'd say. By then she'd given up the baby talk, given up picking Lucy up, too. If she did, she'd get a wrist scratch more often than not. Now, I tried to pretend I liked Frank, and Lulu tried to pretend she liked Lucy, but Lulu gave up pretending a lot sooner than I did. I guess maybe neither one of them, the cat or the woman, could stand being a hypocrite. I don't think Lucy was the only reason Lulu left. Hell, I know it wasn't. But I'm sure Lucy helped Lulu Bell make her final decision. Pets can live a long time, you know. So the present I got for our second was really the straw that broke the camel's back. Tell that to dear Abby. The cat's talking was maybe the worst as far as Lulu was concerned. She couldn't stand it. One night, Lulu Bell says to me, "If that cat doesn't stop yowling, LT, I think I'm going to hit it with an encyclopedia." "That's not yowling," I said. "That's chatting." "Well," Lulu says, "I wish it would stop chatting." And right about then, Lucy jumped into my lap, and she did shut up. She always did, except for a little low purring way back in her throat, purring that really was purring. I scratched between her ears like she likes, and I happened to look up. Lulu turned her eyes back on her book, but before she did, what I saw was real hate. Not for me, for screw Lucy. Throw an encyclopedia at it. She looked like she liked to stick the cat between two encyclopedias and just kind of clap it to death. Sometimes Lulu would come into the kitchen and catch the cat up on the table and swat it off. I asked her once if she'd ever seen me swat Frank off the bed that way. He'd get up on it, you know, always on her side and leave these nasty tangles of white hair. When I said that, Lulu gave me a kind of grin. Her teeth were showing anyway. "If you ever tried, you'd find yourself a finger or three shy, more likely," she says. Sometimes Lucy really was screw Lucy. Cats are moody, and sometimes they get manic. Anybody who's ever had one will tell you that. Their eyes get big and kind of glary. Their tails bush out. They go racing around the house. Sometimes they'll rear right back up on their back legs and prance, boxing at the air like they're fighting something that they can see, but human beings can't. Lucy got into a mood like that one night when she was about a year old. Couldn't have been more than 3 weeks from the day when I come home and found that Lulu Bell was gone. Anyway, Lucy came racing in from the kitchen, did a kind of racing slide on the wood floor, jumped over Frank, went skittering up the living room drapes, paw over paw. Left some pretty good holes in them with threads hanging down. Then she just perched on the top of the rod, staring around the room with her blue eyes all big and wild and the tip of her tail snapping back and forth. Frank only jumped a little and then put his muzzle back on Lulu Bell's shoe, but the cat scared the hell out of Lulu Bell, who was deep in her book, and when she looked up at the cat, I could see that outright hate in her eyes again. "All right," she said, "that's enough. Everybody out of the goddamn pool. We're going to find a good home for that little blue-eyed bitch. And if we're not smart enough to find a home for a purebred Siamese, we're going to take her to the animal shelter. I've had enough." "What do you mean?" I asked her. "Are you blind?" she asks. "Look what she did to my drapes. They're full of holes." "You want to see drapes with holes in them," I say. "Why don't you go upstairs and look at the ones on my side of the bed? The bottoms are all ragged because he chews them." "That's different," she says, glaring at me. "That's different, and you know it." Well, I wasn't going to let that lie. No way was I going to let that one lie. "The only reason you think it's different is because you like the dog and you don't like the cat I gave you," I says. "But I'll tell you one thing, Mrs. DeWitt. You take the cat to the animal shelter for clawing the drapes on Tuesday. I can guarantee I'll take the dog to the animal shelter for chewing the bedroom drapes on Wednesday. You got that?" She looked at me and started to cry. She threw her book at me and called me a bastard. A mean bastard. I tried to grab hold of her, make her stay long enough for me to at least try to make up. If there was a way to make up without backing down, which I wasn't going to do that time. But she pulled her arm out of my hand and ran out of the room. Frank ran after her. They went upstairs and the bedroom door slammed. I gave her half an hour or so to cool off, and then I went upstairs myself. The bedroom door was still shut, and when I started to open it, I was pushing against Frank. I could move him, but it was slow work with him sliding across the floor, and also noisy work. He was growling, and I mean growling, my friends. That was no fucking purr. If I'd gone in there, he would have tried his solemn best to bite my manhood off. I slept on the couch that night, first time. A month later, give or take, she was gone. If LT had timed his story right, most times he did, practice makes perfect, the bell signaling back to work at the W.S. Heperton processed meat plants of Ames, Iowa would ring just about then, sparing him any questions from the new men, the old hands knew, and knew better than to ask, about whether or not LT and Lulu Bell had reconciled, or if he knew where she was today, or the all-time $64,000 question, if she and Frank were still together. There's nothing like the back-to-work bell to close off life's more embarrassing questions. Well, LT would say, putting away his thermos and then standing up and giving a stretch, it all led me to create what I call LT's theory of pets. They'd look at him expectantly, just as I had the first time I had heard him use that grand phrase, but they would always end up feeling let down, just as I always had. A story that good deserved a better punchline, but LT's never changed. If your dog and cat are getting along better than you and your wife, he'd say, you better expect to come home some night and find a Dear John note on your refrigerator door. He told that story a lot, as I've said, and one night when he came to my house for dinner, he told it to my wife and my wife's sister. My wife invited Holly, who had been divorced almost 2 years, so the boys and the girls would balance up. I'm sure that's all it was, because Rosalind never liked L.T. DeWitt. Most people do. Most people take to him like hands take to warm water, but Rosalind has never been most people. She didn't like the story of the note on the fridge or the pets either. I could tell she didn't, although she chuckled in the right places. Holly? Shit, I don't know. I've never been able to tell what that girl's thinking. Mostly just sits there with her hands in her lap, smiling like Mona Lisa. It was my fault that time, though, and I admit it. LT didn't want to tell it, but I kind of egged him on because it was so quiet around the dinner table, just the click of silverware and the clink of glasses, and I could almost feel my wife disliking LT. It seemed to be coming off her in waves. And if LT had been able to feel that little Jack Russell Terrier disliking him, he probably would be able to feel my wife doing the same. That's what I figured anyhow. So he told it, mostly to please me, I suppose, and he rolled his eyeballs in all the right places as if saying, gosh, she fooled me right good and proper, didn't she? And my wife chuckled here and there. She sounded as phony to me as Monopoly money looks, and Holly smiled her little Mona Lisa smile with her eyes downcast. Otherwise, the dinner went off all right, and when it was over, LT told Rosalind that he thanked her for a sportin' fine meal, whatever that is, and she told him to come any time. She and I like to see his face in the place. That was a lie on her part, but I doubt there was ever a dinner party in the history of the world where a few lies weren't told. So it went off all right, at least until I was driving him home. LT started to talk about how it would be a year Lulu Bell had been gone in just another week or so, their fourth anniversary, which is flowers if you're old-fashioned and electrical appliances if you're newfangled. Then he said as how Lulu Bell's mother, at whose house Lulu Bell had never shown up, was going to put up a marker with Lulu Bell's name on it at the local cemetery. Mrs. Sims says we have to consider her as one dead, LT said, and then he began to bawl. I was so shocked, I nearly ran off the goddamn road. He cried so hard that when I was done being shocked, I began to be afraid all that pent-up grief might kill him with a stroke or a burst blood vessel or something. He rocked back and forth in the seat and slammed his open hands down on the dashboard. It was like there was a twister loose inside him. Finally, I pulled over to the side of the road and began patting his shoulder. I could feel the heat of his skin right through his shirt, so hot it was baking. Come on, LT, I said. That's enough. I just miss her, he said in a voice so thick with tears I could barely understand what he was saying. Just so goddamn much. I come home and there's no one there but the cat, crying and crying, and pretty soon I'm crying too. Both of us crying while I fill up her dish with that goddamn muck she eats. He turned his flushed, streaming face full on me. Looking back into it was almost more than I could take, but I did take it. I had to take it. Who had gotten him telling the story about Lucy and Frank and the note on the refrigerator that night after all? It hadn't been Mike Wallace or Dan Rather, that was for sure. So I looked back at him. I didn't quite dare hug him in case that twister should somehow jump from him to me, but I kept patting his arm. I think she's alive somewhere, that's what I think, he said. His voice was still thick and wavery, but there was a kind of pitiful, weak defiance in it as well. He wasn't telling me what he believed, but what he wished he could believe. I'm pretty sure of that. Well, I said, you can believe that. No law against it, is there? And it isn't as though they found her body or anything. I like to think of her out there in Nevada, singing in some little casino hotel, he said. Not in Vegas or Reno. She couldn't make it in one of the big towns, but in Winnemucca or Ely, I'm pretty sure she could get by, someplace like that. She just saw a singer wanted sign and gave up her idea of going home to her mother. Hell, the two of them never got on worth a shit anyway. That's what Lou used to say. And she could sing, you know. I don't know if you ever heard her, but she could. I don't guess she was great, but she was good. The first time I saw her, she was singing in the lounge of the Marriott Hotel in Columbus, Ohio, that was. Or, another possibility, he hesitated, then went on in a lower voice. Prostitution is legal out there in Nevada, you know. Not in all of the counties, but in most of them. She could be working at one of them Green Lantern trailers there or the Mustang Ranch. Lots of women have got a streak of whore in them, and Lou was one. And I don't mean she stepped around on me or slept around on me. I don't mean that. So I can't say how I know, but I do. She could be in one of those places. He stopped, eyes distant, maybe imagining Lulu Bell on a bed in the back room of a Nevada trailer whorehouse. Lulu Bell wearing nothing but stockings, washing off some unknown cowboy's works, while from the other room came the sound of Steve Earle and the Dukes singing 6 Days on the Road, or a TV playing Hollywood Squares. Lulu Bell whoring but not dead, the car by the side of the road, the little Subaru she had brought to the marriage, meaning nothing. The way an animal's look, so seemingly attentive, usually means nothing. I can believe it if I want, he said, swiping at his swollen eyes with the insides of his wrists. Sure, I said. You bet, LT. Wondering what the grinning men who listened to his story while they ate their lunches would make of this LT, this shaking man with his pale cheeks and red eyes and hot skin. Hell, he said, I do believe that. He hesitated, then said it again. I do believe that. When I got back, Rosalind was in bed with a book in her hand and the covers pulled up to her breasts. Holly had gone home while I was driving LT back to his house. Rosalind was in a bad mood, and I found out why soon enough. The woman behind the Mona Lisa smile had been quite taken with my friend, smitten by him maybe, and my wife most definitely did not approve. How did he lose his license, she asked, before I could answer. Drinking, wasn't it? Drinking, yes, OUI. I sat down on my side of the bed and slipped off my shoes, but that was nearly 6 months ago, and if he keeps his nose clean another 2 months, he gets it back. I think he will. He goes to AA, you know. My wife grunted, clearly not impressed. I took off my shirt, sniffed the armpits, and hung it back in the closet. I'd only worn it an hour or two, just for dinner. You know, my wife said, I think it's a wonder the police didn't look a little more closely at him when she disappeared. They asked him some questions, I said, but only to get as much information as they could. There was never any question of him doing it, Roz. There were never any suspicions of him. Oh, you're sure? As a matter of fact, I am. I know some stuff. Lulu Bell called her mother from a hotel in eastern Colorado the day she left, and called her again from Salt Lake City, Utah, the next day. She was fine then. Those were both weekdays, and LT was at the plant. He was at the plant the day they found her car parked off that ranch road near Caliente as well. Unless he can magically transport himself from place to place in the blink of an eye, he didn't kill her. Besides, he wouldn't. He loved her. She grunted. It's this hateful sound of skepticism she makes sometimes. After almost 30 years of marriage, that sound still makes me want to turn on her and yell at her to stop it, to shit or get off the pot, either say what she has on her mind or keep quiet. This time I thought about telling her how LT had cried, how it had been like there was a cyclone inside him, tearing loose everything that wasn't nailed down. I thought about it, but I didn't. Women don't trust tears from men. They may say different, but down deep, they do not trust tears from men. Maybe you ought to call the police yourself, I said. Offer them a little of your expert help. Point out the stuff they missed, just like Angela Lansbury on Murder, She Wrote. I swung my legs into bed. She turned off the light. We lay there in darkness. When she spoke again, her tone was gentler. I don't like him. That's all. I don't like him, and I never have. Yeah, I said, I guess that's clear. And I didn't like the way he looked at Holly. Which meant, of course, as I found out eventually, that she hadn't liked the way Holly had looked at him. When she wasn't looking down at her plate, that was. I'd prefer you didn't ask him back to dinner, she said. I kept quiet. It was late. I was tired. It had been a hard day, a harder evening, and I was tired. The last thing I wanted was to have an argument with my wife when I was tired and she was worried. That's the sort of argument where one of you ends up spending the night on the couch. And the only way to stop an argument like that is to be quiet. In a marriage, words are like rain. And the land of a marriage is filled with dry washes and arroyos that can become raging rivers in almost the wink of an eye. The therapists believe in talk, but most of them are either divorced or queer. It's silence which is a marriage's best friend. Silence. After a while, my best friend rolled over on her side, away from me and into the place where she goes when she finally gives up the day. I lay awake a little while longer, thinking of a dusty little car, perhaps once white, parked nose down in the ditch beside a ranch road out in the Nevada desert, not too far from Caliente. The driver's side door standing open, the rearview mirror torn off its post and lying on the floor, the front seat sodden with blood and tracked over by the animals that had come to investigate, perhaps to sample. There was a man. They assumed he was a man, it almost always is, who had butchered 5 women out in that part of the world, 5 in 3 years, mostly during the time LT had been living with Lulu Bell. 4 of the women were transients. He would get them to stop somehow, then pull them out of their cars, rape them, dismember them with an axe, leave them a rise or two away for the buzzards and the crows and the weasels. The 5th one was an elderly rancher's wife. The police call this killer the Axe Man. As I write this, the Axe Man has not been captured, nor has he killed again. If Cynthia Lulu Bell Sims DeWitt was the Axe Man's 6th victim, then she has been his last, at least so far. There is still some question, however, as to whether or not she was his 6th victim. If not in most minds, that question exists in the part of LT's mind which is still allowed to hope. The blood on the seat wasn't human blood, you see. It didn't take the Nevada State Forensics Unit 5 hours to determine that. The ranch hand who found Lulu Bell's Subaru saw a cloud of circling birds 1/2 mile away, and when he reached them, he found not a dismembered woman, but a dismembered dog. Little was left but bones and teeth. The predators and scavengers had had their day, and there's not much meat on a Jack Russell Terrier to begin with. The Axe Man most certainly got Frank. Lulu Bell's fate is probable, but far from certain. Perhaps, I thought, she is alive, singing Tie a Yellow Ribbon at the jailhouse in Ely, or Take a Message to Michael at the Rose of Santa Fe in Hawthorne. Backed up by a 3-piece combo, old men trying to look young in red vests and black string ties, Or maybe she's blowing GM cowboys in Austin or Wendover, bending forward until her breasts press flat on her thighs beneath a calendar showing tulips in Holland, gripping set after set of flabby buttocks in her hands, and thinking about what to watch on TV that night when her shift is done. Perhaps she just pulled over to the side of the road and walked away. People do that. I know it. And you do too. Sometimes people just say, fuck it, and walk away. Maybe she left Frank behind, thinking someone would come along and give him a good home, only it was the Axeman who came along in. But no. No. I met Lulu Bell, and for the life of me, I can't see her leaving a dog to most likely roast to death or starve to death in the barrens. Especially not a dog she loved the way she loved Frank. No. LT hadn't been exaggerating about that. I saw them together, and I know. She could still be alive somewhere, technically speaking at least. LT's right about that. Just because I can't think of a scenario that would lead from that car with the door hanging open and the rearview mirror lying on the floor and the dog lying dead and crow-picked two rises away, just because I can't think of a scenario that would lead from that place near Caliente to some other place where Lulu Bell Sims sings or sews or blows truckers, safe and unknown, well, that doesn't mean that no such scenario exists. As I told LT, it isn't as though they found her body. They just found her car and the remains of the dog a little way from the car. Lulu Bell herself could be anywhere. You can see that. I couldn't sleep, and I felt thirsty. I got out of bed, went into the bathroom, and took the toothbrushes out of the glass we keep by the sink. I filled the glass with water. Then I sat down on the closed lid of the toilet and drank the water and thought about the sound that Siamese cats make, that weird crying, how it must sound good if you love them, how if you love them, it must sound like coming home. Thank you. I'll be back.
The Road Virus Heads North. Read by J.O. Sanders.
Richard Connell wasn't frightened when he first saw the picture at the yard sale in Rosewood. He was fascinated by it, and he felt he'd had the good luck to find something which might be very special. But fright? No. It didn't occur to him until later, not until it was too late, as he might have written in one of his own numbingly successful novels, that he had felt much the same way about certain illegal drugs as a young man. He had gone down to Boston to participate in a Penn New England conference titled The Threat of Popularity. You could count on Penn to come up with such subjects, Connell had found. It was actually sort of comforting. He drove the 260 miles from Derry rather than flying because he'd come to a plot impasse on his latest book and wanted some quiet time to try to work it out. At the conference, he sat on a panel where people who should have known better asked him where he got his ideas and if he ever scared himself. He left the city by way of the Tobin Bridge, then got on Route 1. He never took the turnpike when he was trying to work out problems. The turnpike lulled him into a state that was like dreamless waking sleep. It was restful, but not very creative. The stop-and-go traffic on the coast road, however, acted like grit inside an oyster. It created a fair amount of mental activity, and sometimes even a pearl. Not, he supposed, that his critics would use that word. In an issue of Esquire last year, Bradley Simons had begun his review of Nightmare City this way. Richard Connell, who writes like Jeffrey Dahmer cooks, has suffered a fresh bout of projectile vomiting. He has titled this most recent mass of ejecta, Nightmare City.